News of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Supporters of Israel attacked a pro-Palestinian protest camp at the University of California in Los Angeles. Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen has more.
Demonstrators on both sides sprayed each other with unknown substances and fights broke out. Calm was later restored after police arrived on the scene. The violence followed an announcement on Tuesday by UCLA administrators that the encampment was unlawful and violated university policy. The school's chancellor said it included people unaffiliated with the campus, though he provided no evidence of the presence of outsiders. The October 7th attack on southern Israel by Hamas militants from the Gaza Strip and the ensuing Israeli offensive on the Palestinian enclave have unleashed the biggest outpouring of U.S. student activism since the anti-racism protests of 2020.
That was Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is pushing Israel and Hamas to reach a ceasefire deal. AP correspondent Sagar Magani has that story.
The deal would free hostages and pause the nearly 7 months of Gaza fighting.
No delays, no excuses. The time is now.
In Tel Aviv, Blinken told Israel ceremonial president Hamas will be to blame if the deal does not happen. The talks appear serious, but there are big differences on a key issue. Hamas wants the Israeli offensive to end if all hostages are freed. Israel's only offering a pause. After a meeting today, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office says he made clear to Blinken Israel will carry out a military operation in Rafah, which it calls Hamas's last major stronghold. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Join VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises as we delve into the heart of the world's most pressing conflicts and crises, from the Israel-Hamas war to the Russian-Ukraine war. This is VOA News. Lawmakers in the European nation of Georgia have moved a step closer to passing a law that critics fear will stifle media freedom and endanger the country's European Union membership bid. Tens of thousands of residents in the capital, Tbilisi, have marched for days against the bill. Opposition party leader Alain Kashataria says it's about more than just a law.
The oligarch has made it clear it's a geopolitical shift by Georgian dream to drag back Georgia into Russian influence and to close the European future. But the thing is that the majority of this country wants the opposite.
Dozens of people were arrested in the latest rallies. Police used water cannons, tear gas, and pepper spray against the demonstrators. Protesters denounced the bill as the Russian law because neighboring Russia uses similar legislation to stigmatize independent news media and organizations critical of the Kremlin. A third and final reading of the bill is ahead. The U.S. State Department released a statement Wednesday condemning the bill's advancement, calling it Kremlin-inspired foreign influence. A surprise announcement that revealed Haiti's new prime minister is dividing a recently installed transitional council tasked with choosing new leaders for the gang-riddled Caribbean country. VOA's Tommy McNeil reports.
Four of seven council members with voting power said Tuesday that they had chosen Fritz Belizaire as prime minister. Many Haitians were taken aback by their declaration and unexpected political alliance. The council members who opposed Belizaire are now weighing options, including fighting the decision or resigning from the council. Belizaire served as Haiti's sports minister from 2006 to 2011. Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Officials with the Kenyan government and the Red Cross said Wednesday that floods and landslides across the East African country have killed more than 180 people since March, with hundreds of thousands forced to leave their homes. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino reports.
Hundreds of thousands have been forced from their homes. Dozens have also been killed in neighboring Tanzania and Burundi. More rain is expected in Kenya in the coming days, according to the country's meteorological department. Torrential rain and floods have destroyed homes, roads, bridges, and other infrastructure across the region. In Kitengela, about 20 miles from the capital, Nairobi, Kenya Red Cross workers on Wednesday were helping rescue those marooned by floodwaters. The death toll in Kenya exceeds that from floods triggered by the El Nino weather phenomenon late last year. Those rains followed the worst drought in large parts of East Africa in decades.
That was Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino. International Edition delivers insight into world news through eyewitnesses, correspondent reports, and analysis from experts and newsmakers. This is Richard Green for VOA News.
Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty, Washington. Today is Thursday, May 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are following. The United States resolves to find an end to Sudan's civil war.
Our strategy, plain and simple, is to end the war by supercharging our diplomacy around the whole of government, raising the cost of those fighting and fueling the war, and building an alliance of regional partners.
South Africa's MK party faces voter forgery allegations. A new generation leads the charge to stop hate speech from spreading in Rwanda. A Guinean imam vows to hold prayers in his local Mandingo language. Liberian President Joseph Boakai reports on his first 100 days in office.
We earmark 11 key projects across the country to make sure their primary roles are all pliable during all season.
And experts warn that unexploded landmines pose a threat in African nations and others around the world. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. Senator Ben Cardin, the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has once again sounded the alarm about the atrocities taking place in Sudan as war rages on in the Eastern African nation. He was speaking Wednesday at a hearing on the conflict and humanitarian emergency in Sudan. VOA's Douglas Mpuga followed the hearing and has this report.
In his opening remarks, Senator Cardin also called for external actors to stop arming the belligerents in Sudan and called for a diplomatic solution. The hearing comes after the chair sent a letter to President Biden requesting a determination on whether Sudan's rapid support forces and its leader, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, should be subject to sanctions for gross violations of human rights under the Global Magnitsky Human Rights Accountability Act.
Ceasefire after ceasefire has been violated. The risk of further atrocities is high. Diplomatic efforts to end the conflict have failed. I think we need to make it clear to both parties and their foreign backers the cost of a continued conflict is higher than the cost of coming to the negotiating table. A report from last year by the United Nations panel on experts found evidence that the UAE was giving arms to RSF.
The Senate expressed concern for the plight of civilians caught up in the fighting, especially now as the fighting approaches Al-Fasham. It's the only remaining city in Sudan's Darfur region. The rapid support forces have not taken over. Eyewitnesses report attacks on over 16 nearby towns, with entire villages burned to the ground.
Starving civilians are trying to escape the violence with their belongings on foot. As the death toll climbs, the United Nations has warned that the lives of 800,000 civilians who are still living in the city are in danger. It has been more than a year since the current conflict erupted in Sudan between the RSF and the Sudanese armed forces.
The senator noted with concern the role of external actors in the conflict and called on them to stop arming the belligerents. Noting that there has been a blatant violation of the UN arms embargo that has been in place for decades, Senator Cardin emphasized that the Sudanese people deserve security and prosperity as much as any other people in the world. U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, Tom Perriello, who appeared before the committee to discuss the horrific crisis in Sudan, said the war and humanitarian crisis in Sudan are already catastrophic. Worse yet, he added, the most likely trajectory forward is towards a famine, fighting that takes on increasingly ethnic and regional aspects, and the possibility of a failed state of 50 million people on the strategic eastern gateway to the Sahel.
Our strategy, plain and simple, is to end the war. It's to end the war by supercharging our diplomacy around the whole of government, raising the costs of those fighting and fueling the war, and building an alliance of regional partners with enough leverage to compel the two sides to accept a deal that we do not believe they will reach on their own that hands the Sudanese people back their future. Second, we're continuing to raise the cost of fighting and fueling the war. We're engaged directly with both fighting factions, including top generals, to deter escalation and atrocities.
The goal, he said, is to build the political will sufficient enough to force the actors to silence the guns. For VOA, I'm Douglas Mpuga in Washington.
Liberia's President Joseph Boakai's first 100 days accomplishments are being criticized by the former ruling party, the Coalition for Democratic Change, which is now the leading opposition party. Denise Nipson reports from Monrovia.
Wednesday, May 1, marked the first 100 days since President Joseph Boakai was inaugurated, and he promised to deliver on certain tangibles during his 100 days in office. Addressing the nation Wednesday evening, President Boakai mentioned some of his administration's successes, including road rehabilitation, which is going on in parts of Liberia.
We earmarked 11 key projects across the country to make sure the primary roads are all pliable during all seasons. The Ministry of Public Works has been undertaking major road corridor projects totaling 783.5 kilometers. To date, contractors, equipment, and logistics have been heavily mobilized in active work such as clearing, shipping and stabilization of critical spots.
The president also touted the supply of essential medicines and access to quality health care.
The government has ensured that essential medicines and medical supplies are distributed to 100% of the efforts of 13 counties in the country. With last mile distributions to Monserrato and Margibi counties having been achieved 100%. To improve diagnostic capacity at health centers, address critical illness, the government has identified sites to build 4 regional diagnostic centers in the country.
President Boakai said his administration will unveil its national development plan in the coming days and explained some of the economic, political, and social strategies that will improve the quality of life for Liberians. However, Eugene Namwe, the chairman of the Strategic Committee of the Opposition Coalition for Democratic Change, CDC, describes Boakai's first 100 days in office as a failure.
We have cataloged all of what he promised in various sectors. In education, he failed in health, he failed in agriculture, he failed in rule of law, he failed in governance and administration. Yeah, we have cataloged using data and all of the available evidence and the benchmark that we use to arrive at our conclusions were the very document published by the Unity Party, which they described as the 100-day deliverables. So it was not 100-day deliverables, it was 100-day of failure.
Eugene Namwe told VOA that most of the road rehabilitation mentioned by President Boakai was finalized during the CDC administration. Another opposition leader, Simon Freeman, the standard bearer of the Movement for Progressive Change, says nothing concrete has been done in Boakai's 100 days in office.
The 100 days deliverable, no car will be stuck in the mud. That has not been met. And many other promises were made, and we're not sure what compelled those promises, but we can clearly see that the government has not even indicated what its economic policies are.
Liberians, I hope for that the government can begin to fast track the development they are yearning for. I'm Denise Nipson in Monrovia, Liberia.
The national spokesperson for South Africa's Umkhonto we Sizwe, or the MK Party, says it is a victim of a fraudster. This as the Independent Electoral Commission, the IEC, is investigating if the MK forged some of the 15,000 signatures required to register for the May 29 general election. The MK has survived several court battles since it was revealed that former President Jacob Zuma could be its presidential candidate. Spokesperson Nkamulo Dlala tells me that the party found out that the so-called whistleblower is a disgruntled African National Congress ANC volunteer whose request to represent the MK as a parliamentary candidate was denied.
The reality is that we rely on volunteers off the back of the IEC, which we believe has brought about punitive measures for the first time in this election, requesting new parties to, you know, sign up citizens in the country that would support or are willing to support the political party at a provincial level. And we then rely on volunteers. In this case, this individual, this rogue individual, who is a former ANC member, he has made utterances that say that if he's not going to be on the national list, then, you know, the MK fire will burn.
So you are saying this was a disgruntled member of your party that went to the police?
No, it can't be a disgruntled member of our party. It's a disgruntled volunteer that wanted to find himself on the list. And then what we then do is we then naturally have to do a vetting. And we found that this individual has got a sketchy background. He's a fraudster. And we can't be associated with fraudsters. When we picked this up, we then decided we're not going to put him on the list. He then, by virtue of him being disgruntled, 6 weeks later, when he ought to have done it at that point in time, goes and opens or submits an affidavit that says that he was complicit in forging those signatures. So we're saying that the law enforcement agencies ought to, at that point in time when he made this affidavit, lock him up. Because we're seeing it, we're then a victim to a so-called volunteer who's killed a saboteur from the ANC to sabotage us. And the reason we come to that conclusion is that we then defected back to the ANC. What we're concerned about is that why did the law enforcement agency at that point in time when he made that affidavit, why did the law enforcement agency then not say to him, hold on, you're complicit, let's arrest you right now?
Aside from this allegation, that your party and your possible candidate, former President Jacob Zuma, you have faced many legal challenges for this election alone. What do you make of all these legal challenges?
No, I think the mere fact that you asked me the question is a clear indication that the IEC's conduct is very questionable. Because you and I would not be having this conversation if the IEC was not independent, as they could go out there and position themselves as an independent organization. As far as we're concerned, the IEC now stands for Individual Electoral Congress. They might as well be on the ballot paper.
Nkabule Ndulela is the national spokesperson for South Africa Nkonto Wesizwe, or MK Party. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, May 2nd. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Mine experts warn that unexploded ordnance and landmines pose a threat in African nations and others around the world in conflict. More than 800 mine action leaders attending a United Nations conference in Geneva this week are seeking solutions to this global problem. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
The United Nations Mine Action Service, UNMAS, reports 60 million people around the world are affected by the threat of landmines, leftover ammunition, and explosive devices every day. UNMAS officials say the legacy of contamination from these weapons continues decades after a conflict ends. They also say unexploded ordnance and landmines continue to kill and maim thousands of people and hamper human rights protections and development. UNMAS reports West Africa and the Sahel region, including Ethiopia, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, are some of the most contaminated countries in the world. Paul Heslop, who is chief of mine action for the UN Development Program in Ukraine, has been involved in projects in the Sahel for the past 10 years.
Most of the problem in the Sahel is actually IEDs, improvised explosive devices that are used as or are homemade, similar to what we've seen in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Somalia. And obviously, they are very low cost and fairly easy to make. So, yeah, I think that is the scourge of the Sahel, is the use of IEDs in a fairly, or pressure plate IEDs in a fairly indiscriminate way.
UNMAS says a mine clearance program it ran for many years in Sudan was incredibly successful. Therefore, it says it is very distressing to see Sudan once again being contaminated by these lethal weapons, many of which now are in urban areas where the current war is raging. The agency recorded 1,500 victims of explosive ordnance in the Tigray and Afar regions in northern Ethiopia last year. It notes around 80% of the victims were men and young boys. Francesca Chaudani is chief of the UNMAS Mine Action Program in Ethiopia. She says UNMAS is having difficulty in getting accreditation for non-governmental organizations to conduct surveys and clearance activities in conflict-affected areas.
At the moment, some limited clearance activity have been conducted by the Ethiopian National Defense Forces, so there are no humanitarian clearance that happen in the country because of not having authorization for organization to do so.
However, she adds, there are positive signs that the accreditation requests of four mine clearing groups soon will be granted. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Guinea-Conakry, an Islamic imam has been released from prison after serving a five-month term. He was arrested and sentenced for leading prayers in his native Mandingo language. Despite his jail sentence and pressure from the Guinea Islamic Council, the imam has vowed to continue leading prayers in his local language. Islamic scholars in Guinea say his practice is an abomination, an accusation he describes as unfounded. Reporter Karine Kamara has more from Conakry.
Despite being held for 5 months behind bars as a prisoner of conscience by Guinean authorities, Namfo Ismail Jabi says he continued his practices in prison. He continued to lead prayers in Mandingo and was able to convert over 20 inmates to his sect before he left prison. He says he's learned a lot about life while being locked up. He says his 5 months behind bars is something he has experienced in his 47 years of life. He says while there, he converted 28 inmates to his way of worship and led them in prayers in Mandingo. He says praying in the language you understand and in one that is different are very different. He was later arrested for praying in his local language and was charged with disturbing the peace and religious sabotage. In a defiant mood, the imam again led this year's congregational prayer in his native language in his compound, which is in Kanka, in the east of Guinea, some 600 kilometers from the capital. Dozens of his followers attended the prayer. Namfo decided to build his own mosque after he was banned by the authorities from praying in other mosques and in public places. However, his place of worship was destroyed by angry Muslims who accused him of sacrilege. He described the attack as sabotage and says nothing will discourage him from spreading his religious beliefs in Guinea. Alhaji Fodi Kaba is an Islamic cleric and a member of the Guinean Islamic Council. He says Namfo is a shameless and that the government must take action to avoid a possible confrontation between Namfo's followers and what he calls true Muslims. According to the laws of Islam, all Muslims must pray and read verses in the Quran in Arabic because it is believed to be the word of God. But this is the first time in Guinea and in the sub-region that the concept has been openly challenged by a Muslim sect leader. Namfo has named his order Jerekolumbaya, which literally means in Mandingo self-pride. Namfo is a Mandingo scholar Onku. Many of the Islamic texts and other books have been translated. But does that mean one should pray in Mandingo? I put this question to Mori Konde, one of the key professors here in Conakry.
He
says scholars have translated the Quran and Hadith into Mandingo to allow those who do not understand Arabic to read them in local language. He says it's up to the individual to decide whether to use Mandingo while praying, but that is not mandatory. On the streets of Conakry, this is what supporters on both sides have to say. Namfo has right to pray in Mandingo because that's what he understands best and that God hears all languages. Abdul Bangula says Namfo is not a good Muslim because he do not pray in other languages, so he has to be severely punished. Yakuba Sisi says Namfo wants to sabotage Islam. He says he knows how to read the verses in Quran in Arabic, and if nothing is done to stop Namfo, the situation will get worse. The standoff between the Islamic Religious Council and the government on the one hand, and Namfo Jabi and his followers on the other, are far from over. Both sides claim they are right, as both are claiming to be on the right path. And Namfo says for him, it's a matter of upholding freedom of conscience in Guinea. For VOA Africa, I am Karim Kamara in Conakry.
Hate speech fueled Rwanda's tragic 1994 genocide against the Tutsis, resulting in the loss of around 800,000 people. Today, a new generation, including some very determined Generation Z members in Rwanda, is leading the charge to stop hate speech from spreading again and working towards a future of unity and understanding. Sinadu Toro reports from Kigali, Rwanda.
Mama!
In a dark, quiet room, Clara, a young Rwandan, tearfully confronts her mother. Born long after a genocide forced the family to flee, she seeks the truth about her roots. Clara is a fictional character in a stage play presented by the Rwandan youth organization, Peace and Love Proclaimers, or PLP. She represents a majority of Rwandan Gen Zs, says the group's head, Israel Nuru Mupenzi. Over 100 days in 1994, Hutu extremists massacred some 800,000 minority Tutsis and moderate Hutus in what is known today as the Rwandan genocide against Tutsis. 30 years on, a new generation feels lost in a broken society, says Mupenzi.
We were not there, but we are now facing the aftermath. We are seeing our parents and our neighbors are closing doors to each other because of lack of trust. Some couples are breaking up because of that. The parents, and my parents said he can't, because he can't allow me to be married with that family.
Parents, hunted by their past, are reluctant to share why.
They kind of try to hide it and say, Dad, you don't want to talk about this, but you know you have to tell me about this so that I can know what to do.
So they go to the internet and social media for answers. But social media influencer Noela Shaka says the space is very unhealthy.
They don't want to accept what caused it.
She explains the perpetrators of the 1994 crimes fled the country and continue to use social media to spread hate. Their goal, she says, is to radicalize the youth against each other.
So we get attacked, certain groups, they target you, they always come in your comment, they say you, they call you names, slut, Tutsis. Yeah, you're not comfortable.
Many youths are angry, according to Rwandan artist and PLP creative director Colin Kazungu. He says some youth react to these hate speeches by writing songs and poems about violence and revenge.
Yes, he survived.
To help, he's using entertainment, arts and sports to dispel the hate and also create a safe space for genocide conversation.
Art has a way to your heart, even when a speech or a president's speech cannot go straight to your heart. But I can talk to your heart with music, even before a government official gets a platform to talk to you. Because many people follow music than they follow political things.
Kazungu says the toxicity around genocide conversations drives most youth away from the topic. But through arts, entertainment and other fun events, PLP has seen them re-engage.
People are now starting to understand that we need to take part in this journey to fight genocide ideology, in this journey to say never again, to make never again a reality.
The Peace and Love Proclaimers, together with youth artists in Rwanda, continue to raise awareness through community and school engagements. They have about 60 partner schools where they organize entertainment and education events, including peace walks all year round. Sena Nutot, VOA, Kigali.
And that's it for this Thursday, May 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton, Washington, saying, have a great day, and please be safe whatever you do.